Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Johnny's son is an architect, designer, engineer, artist, playwright, and comedy writer who originally calls Toronto home. Son is currently a doctoral student at MIT, a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, and a creative researcher at the Harvard Metal Lab, where he studies social media and online community. He is a graduate of the Yale School of Architecture, where he was awarded many prizes and fellowships, and he is an honors graduate of the Infrastructure Program in Engineering Science at the University of Toronto. As impressive as all of those credentials are, for almost 500,000 of his followers on Twitter, Johnny Sun is a clever guy who's at the forefront of new forms of communication, language, and terminology. His new best-selling graphic novel is something of a meditation on the social media landscape. It's called Everyone's a Alien When You're a Alien Too, and is available now via Harper Perennial. Johnny and I met in a streetside park in downtown Toronto recently to discuss his relationship with the city he once called home, the importance of Second City and improv and sketch comedy to his outlook on life and his academic pursuits, his comedic influences, the state of social media and communication, his book, and much more. Sponsored by Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, and Granddad's Donuts, this is Johnny Sun on the 337th episode of Creative Control with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, John. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well. It's nice to meet with you here. We're in a park in Toronto.
That's right.
Essentially, right across from a super fancy hotel.
Uh-huh.
Which you're not staying
we
at.
We both were not staying at, and we both walked into, and we're like, oh, this is not
for me.
Where, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I try to be like those people, but I can't be like those people.
They
have a different... There's a guy with a BMW, and the roof was coming up, and I was like, I couldn't even fathom any of it.
Yeah, they just pay that guy to stay out there.
I think they do.
So they scare off people like us.
Every time you walk by this hotel, there's a slew of fancy cars, and
I
it's very intimidating.
Yeah,
on some level. I also don't care, but I'm also a little intimidated.
Yeah,
yeah. So, are you from Toronto?
Yes, Toronto. Not born, but raised.
Where are you from?
So I was born in Calgary,
but I
moved to Toronto when I was 10 or 11.
Okay,
and so I've lived here all my teenage and most of my adult life.
Like in the city?
Yeah, right downtown.
You're actually a city guy.
Yeah, I'm a city boy.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what's it like being back?
I love it. Every time I'm back, it feels like home. Like, I feel way more comfortable and in my own skin and, like, I belong.
This is your home.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like a homing beacon for you.
Absolutely, yeah.
When did you leave?
2012.
Oh, you haven't been gone that long.
Yeah.
So the change that I've observed, I mean, do you notice much of a difference?
Every time I come back, it's like an uncanny valley thing where,
yeah,
like, a few things change and then most things are kind of the same but maybe a bit, like, older or something.
Right.
So it definitely is different from the memory, but still feels the same.
Do you have particularly, I know you say it's home, it's familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have particularly fond memories or of Toronto or things you need to go and do or see?
Oh, man. I think every time I'm back, I'm back for a few days tops. Right. And so it's tough for me to consistently go to things. I like to go to Second City shows.
Oh.
When I can. The Fringe is playing right now, and I'm missing the shows this time. But every time I'm back during Fringe, I like to go to see the Fringe shows.
Is that your community?
I was a member of those communities, but those definitely were the places that I went to to watch things and to feel like I was part of something.
Right.
So yeah.
Because you have you're a comedian. What is your comedy background in this city? It's those things, obviously.
Yeah, so. Well, I did some sort of training at Second City. I did some improv and sketch writing, okay. And I'd never done a Fringe show, but I was an average Fringe goer.
Right.
And what else? I used to do sketch comedy with a student group called School Night, which was over at the University of Toronto.
Okay.
And so I was part of that for a while. And from that, we kind of did a few sketch fest things and a few kind of sketch comedy events around the city and stuff.
Okay. Yeah. And this was when you were a teenager or in your
20s? Yeah, undergrad.
Undergrad, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. What was your entry point into comedy?
My entry point into comedy.
I mean, as a fan. Not necessarily as a performer, but I'm always curious, because for me it was going to my cousin's house in Scarborough.
Yeah.
We would drive from where I was raised in Cambridge, Ontario.
Yeah.
It's about an hour away. So all my mom's sisters and brothers lived in Scarborough. So we'd go to we'd drive there, and we'd end up either staying over or coming home at 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
So I got really used to that almost every weekend. Yeah. But one of the things that I first was exposed to from these trips was Saturday Night Live.
Right,
Letterman even. The TV would be on, and I'm like, I don't think I'm... now I'm like, I don't think I should have been watching that stuff at that age.
Yeah.
But my cousins were older, so they'd watch it.
Yeah.
And that, I was just hooked. It just seemed like a whole other... I didn't know that was on TV.
That's right.
Did you have something like that?
Yeah, I think I had a few. When I was a kid, I loved The Muppet Show.
Oh, of course.
And so I would watch that every... And I was way too young to actually understand. I just liked the Muppets, right?
Right.
And then every few years I go back and rewatch some of the episodes I can find online or whatever. And I'm like, oh, this is an amazing show. This kind of taught me sketch comedy, and it taught me variety show, and it taught me all these different lessons, I think, that I must have picked up when I started watching it. So the Muppet Show was huge. Also Jackie Chan movies.
Oh, interesting.
I guess growing up, as my family immigrated from China.
Oh, okay.
And so I was a child of immigrants. And I think Jackie Chan movies are one thing that kind of crossed the bridge, right? Kind of closed the gap.
Slapstick, physical comedy.
Yeah.
Action.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and so I never thought of it as comedy, really, but it was. It was...
This would be the original Jackie Chan movie, so to speak, not the...
Yeah.
Or was it the ones when he came here?
It was both. It was
both.
Rumble in the Bronx, Drunken Master, that type of era, Super Cop.
Yes.
And then later, Shanghai Nights, Shanghai Noon.
Is that the one with Owen Wilson?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Rush Hour.
Right, of course. Bruce Tucker,
American kind of versions of all his Chinese stuff.
Right.
But yeah, I think that... I've never thought of that. I've never been asked that question, but that's kind of one of the...
So when you saw someone who represents your culture, so to speak, your background, performing comedy in America and being accepted, what does that do for you? Did you ever feel alienated about your...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Coming into comedy, a lot of the things that I noticed when I started doing comedy was that my identity kind of precluded what I wanted to do.
Oh, right.
Comedy.
Of course.
So I wanted to I mainly enjoyed writing, but I felt a lot of jokes or parts in sketches that I was in kind of sometimes used my Asian identity as the punchline.
Yes.
Or kind of I was asked to do accents and kind of stuff like that. And you're rolling your eyes because you are familiar.
Same thing.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I also developed sort of survival techniques, self-defense as a kid, where it's like the scene in 8 Mile where Eminem takes all the stuff that's going to come at him at the end scene, and then he just puts it into a freestyle about the... You know what I'm talking
about? That's right,
I did a lot of that. I think I did a lot of stuff that I now would be like, I can't believe what a Uncle Raj I was. playing up what the white kids in my school would have thought was funny.
And
downplaying my culture. And it wasn't until university where people expressed a mature interest and decorum about my culture and be like, oh my God, it must have been so amazing growing up East Indian. And I'd be like, oh, I took it for granted because I just was in a defensive state
right.
about it, right?
You know?
So did you have that?
I definitely had the defensive state. I don't think I, like, because I think I saw a lot of, like, my friends or, like, my peers who are Asian Canadian kind of play up those things. But for me, I was like, whenever someone made some sort of, like, even, like, slight hint at that, like, at the thing that was the thing that they were going for, I would kind of, like, immediately, like, try to shut it off and shut it down. And which was a survival tactic, but for me also, I realized I was, I guess, trying to show white people that I was white as well, which is like the other end of the spectrum,
exactly.
which is kind of
yeah.
like the other problem too. And so, like, it's there's no winning.
There's no real winning, and people, like, we live in a multicultural country, multicultural. This Toronto is known as one of the most multicultural cities. I mean. There was a certain level, I think, maybe more so than some of our contemporaries in other places. I think there was some kind of inherent acceptance of us, but also I think that confusion, and it creates tension between people just walking down the street. So your entry point into comedy was Jackie Chan as a fan.
Yeah.
How do you proceed as a performer? How do you get into it?
Yeah, I mean, as I got older and, like, throughout my in high school, I was really into sketch comedy, and I was into not only, like, Saturday Night Live, which seems to be, like, the thing, like, every high schooler interested in comedy has, like, the phase where SNL is, like, their kind of
temple, it's a late night show. You're probably not supposed to be up that late, and it just felt rebellious at one point.
And, like, if you can get a group of friends to watch it together, then it becomes, like, this, like, religious experience almost, like, every Saturday night you go to church and you watch this thing, and for better or for worse, you stick with it. And so there was that. There was Mad TV, which I didn't watch a lot, but I was still on TV and was there. But
had a very significantly diverse cast compared to SNL.
That's right.
I thought.
And it worked with that cast really well, in some degrees, I think.
Did you watch In Living Color?
I didn't. I was too young for that. I caught the reruns and stuff, and I kind of loved watching those when they were on.
I think that's what prompted them to take a chance on Mad TV.
Oh, interesting.
In Living Color also had to. Well, obviously it was a African-American led show, but it was a diverse cast as well.
Right, absolutely.
And at the time, I was a kid too, so maybe I didn't process. Like, you mentioned The Muppets, which was big for me, but also The Simpsons, these shows that seem to be for kids.
Yeah, that's right.
But then you watch them, like, there's just stuff I get now that I wouldn't have gotten.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, The Simpsons was another one. Like, I used to come home, like, after elementary school and turn it on before my parents got home.
It was so weird.
Yeah.
I had a thing, I have talked about this before, but there was a thing where in syndicated TV, it was like Cheers and Night Court and The Simpsons, things I probably shouldn't have been watching. The Simpsons is you know, it's out there on
it
some
is.
Level.
Yeah,
and it's mind-blowing on some level, and it turned me into a punk, you know?
Exactly.
It totally did.
Yeah.
So you had those things, okay.
Mm-hmm. And then in, like, high school, I fell in love with sketch mainly through SNL.
Okay.
But then, because YouTube existed then,
right.
like, I was able to kind of find all these other shows. Like, there was one called the McLeff program, which was Sean McLeff from Australia.
Oh,
and he
yes,
was, like, this Australian sketch comedy person who, like, did total, like, absurdist, surreal humor, like, a very Australian style, and it was brilliant, and I think is totally part of my like, my comedy DNA now. There was Fry and Laurie, some of the British kind of sketch groups, Peep Show, I'm trying to think of what else, and then, like, and then there was a group of, like, YouTube sketch people, like Derek Comedy, which was Donald Glover's original group. And Britannic, and kind of, like, those YouTube sketch people, The Lonely Island.
Of course.
Right? Good Neighbor was another one, and they're now on SNL,
too.
But that was also a core of it, so...
Was there something about the fact that these platforms were accessible and that people were doing things themselves? Was that inspiring for you?
I don't even think I registered it at that level. I just thought, like, this is really good stuff that I find really funny, and for whatever reason, like, speaks to my sense of humor that I could find. And part of, like, the act of actually searching for these things and, like... like having it have a little bit of effort to get to was really appealing for me, because I liked the idea of, like, working to find these things and, like, following, like, this treasure trail almost to find all these different sketches, as opposed to just tuning in and watching whatever, like, more of a passive kind of consumption.
Yeah.
There was something really cool about, like, this active act of having to search for the good stuff.
It's the same for that was for the same for me for comedy and music.
Yeah,
like I wasn't as comfortable just taking what was presented to me. I wanted to try to dig and find stuff as much as I could. In my youth, now I'm a bit more passive. I'm like, oh yeah, that came my way. I'm going to check that out.
Right.
You often write and talk about alienation and loneliness. Yeah. I'm struck by the fact that you were drawn to sketch, which is ensemble work. Was that significant for you?
I think so. Yeah.
Group work.
Yeah, because I'd never, even when I was watching sketch, I'd never imagined that I'd be able to do something like that. And it really, like, I started out, I think my interest in comedy started out from the writing standpoint. And so when I was watching these sketch things, I would, just like as a teenager, write sketches in my room and write like different comedy scripts and scenes and little plays and things. But it wasn't until I started kind of going to drama class and going to theater class in high school and like, learning how to like play with the other kids and being in an environment actually that allowed me to kind of play with the other kids in a way. I felt like in high school, I didn't really know where I belonged. I didn't feel like I belonged at all. And I had a lot of trouble just like fitting into groups. And so theater or like drama class was like my favorite time of day because it was this way where it's almost like a prescribed like way of interacting with people, or it gave you permission to kind of be open and honest, and that was encouraged.
Right.
Whereas like everywhere else in high school, that was kind of, not encouraged as much.
Discouraged, maybe.
Discouraged,
or not as emphasized, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, theater was, like, the other element of, like, my comedy DNA, where, like, when I got into drama class, my favorite things were, like, the comedic kind of one acts, like David Ives, I think Daniel McIver, and then, like, the theater of the absurd.
Right. Guys. Yeah, you like absurdist stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. So you mentioned you're a teenager writing these sketches in your room. Were there other teenagers you knew doing anything like that?
I mean, I never really, like...
You didn't go out and find people.
I didn't go out and find people. And that really only happened in university when I started. There was, like, a school night. It was that student sketch comedy group that
I joined. Even in those drama classes in high school, like, you weren't galvanized? Like, did you make friends?
I made friends, yeah. I think we, like... And we actually did a few... There were, like, a lot of group projects where you, like, wrote together, but I don't think I, like, ever got into, like, this habit of, like, finding my people and, like, writing with them.
Okay.
It wasn't until grade 12 when I met my friend, Kevin Vidal, who's now, like, a Second City guy, and he's in Working Moms and stuff. But we hit it off right away. We were both, like... We were cast as, like, the two leads in the High School Musical in grade 12. And that was the first time I feel like I found, like, a kindred spirit in terms of someone who wanted to do comedy and who was thinking about, like, how to write in those ways and perform in those ways. And so him and I, like, he was really my, like, the person that I, like, learned how to work with someone with.
That's cool.
Which is kinda cool.
That's good. You need someone like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Often you find one person, really.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of getting a huge group of people.
But you find one person and then it, like, it spins off into all the other stuff.
There's like a chemistry or whatever.
Yeah. And we were writing and then, like, so we would get together and, like, talk about comedy and watch SNL and write sketch all through grade 12 and then through undergrad as well.
Did you go to school together?
We didn't, but we both did school night together.
Oh,
so we both did that sketch comedy group together.
Okay, so you went to the U of T initially after high school?
Yes.
And what was your major?
Engineering.
Engineering?
Yeah.
And did you have minors? Did you take electives and stuff?
I did, what did I do? I did a few, like, I think I did a few, like, I didn't actually do any theater.
No, you didn't.
Things. No.
English, nothing.
No, because engineering is all encompassing.
Very intensive.
They don't give you, if they're minors, they're like minors in other engineering fields.
You can take electives in engineering, can't you?
You
like
can.
You could.
There
but
are
it would
a few
be...
arts things, but like for the most part, it's. Right. I think I took like a philosophy of aesthetics course. I took an architecture course. I took like an art theory course.
Okay.
But then in terms of like the actual theater school, I think everything was more intensive and it overlapped with like most of the engineering classes. So
did you say philosophy of aesthetics?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I still don't really know.
I was going to ask you about your philosophical background.
Sure.
I just wondered if you'd studied philosophy in any. Is that the most you've done?
That's the most I've done.
Just because it has it in the name? I don't even know if that is that technically philosophy?
It was much more of a philosophy class than it was like an art theory
class. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I felt a little bit lost because I thought we'd be talking more about like art and aesthetics, but it was more on the philosophy side. So
now, for those who aren't familiar with you, it's I think, and I don't mean to embarrass you here, and forgive me.
Okay.
So you go to U of T, and then the next thing I know, when you look at your credits, I see Yale.
Yeah, I did my master's of architecture there.
Yale, and then I've seen Harvard.
I'm a fellow at Harvard right now. There's a center called the Berkman Klein Center.
Uh-huh.
And it's a center that it's called the Berkman Klein Center of Internet and Society. And
okay.
they look at like online issues, but from like a social perspective.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Was this because of your, I mean, we'll get to this shortly, but is this because of your social media presence?
Partly, but it's also because I'm doing my doctorate at MIT and I'm looking at like online communities
okay.
there.
So you got UT.
yeah.
You got Yale.
Yeah.
You got Harvard.
Yeah.
And you got MIT.
Yes.
That's all you.
Yes.
How is that? Should I even be allowed to talk to you right now? Shouldn't you be staying at the fancy hotel?
I feel like I shouldn't be allowed to be in those schools. Like, I've constantly been going through all this stuff with the fear that eventually someone, I'll get an email being like, oh, we messed up big time. There was another person we should have let in.
You're clearly a very smart man.
Thank you.
I don't mean to embarrass you, but like these are schools that don't let in people like me. They let in people who are smart.
Yeah.
I'm smart. I'm not dumb.
I think so, yeah.
No, I'm just saying. No, that's an amazing background to have.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so right now you're at MIT studying.
Technically, I'm in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning, but I'm looking at online communities and the ways like groups that form online can have an effect on like the real city environment.
Okay. Yeah. So let's. I'm trying to figure out if there's a thread between you and comedy and finding communities and then just being a superstar at school and then wanting to, again, further explore communities. I mean, I think a lot of people know you from your Twitter feed in particular. Mm. Talk about, I know this sounds ridiculous because I don't remember when I joined Twitter.
Sure, yeah.
I remember being reluctant to join Twitter. Uh-huh. I thought it was just another thing.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. But you joined Twitter at what, I don't know, when you did it. I can't remember.
Yeah.
What was it about the platform that seemed to bring something out of you that maybe, because is it Twitter that basically made you a superstar?
Well, I mean, Twitter was the place that I figured out, I think, a specific voice and a specific style.
Okay.
I found really interesting to write through. I joined Twitter in like 2008.
And okay, early.
It was when Twitter was like the hot new thing and like, I just graduated high school and a bunch of my friends went to different places in different cities. And that was, we were like, let's all join Twitter and like try to keep in touch that way.
Right.
And so for like 4 years after that, that was how I was using it. I was just trying to be like, I just wrote like eating a sandwich or like
sure.
just saw a good movie at like the Bloor Cinema, which is now something else, the Hot Dog Cinema.
The Bloor Cinema. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. And like, I was just tweeting about my day and like trying to keep in touch with my friends.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And that was all while I was still in Toronto and I was still writing comedy and stuff.
You were doing what most people did, taking pictures of their food, just saying I got home from a thing, whatever. Yeah, status update.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And while I was being like a normal person on Twitter, I started following like just like big comedy accounts. And eventually I started finding other stranger comedy accounts that like were just popping up like native to Twitter.
Uh-huh,
Not like stand-up comedians who were telling jokes on Twitter, but really just like anonymous people who had found Twitter and started writing hilarious,
the weird
things.
Twitter, as I've heard it.
Yeah, the quote weird Twitter unquote people. And I'd been following them for a while and I was like, this is kind of fun. But it wasn't until I moved to the US for architecture school that I lost, because I moved, I couldn't like hang out with my comedy friends in Toronto
here,
anymore.
Yeah, right.
So I needed a place to write comedy and I thought, well, I'm following all these like weird, surreal, absurd kind of joke tellers on Twitter, so I guess I'll play and try to like write with them and like see if I can be part of that kind of large internet writers room, which is how I still see Twitter in a
yes,
way.
Yes, right.
And so that was when I started, I guess, like messing with I guess like the aesthetic of the text.
Right.
The way I was really interested in how, like, I mean, everyone is kind of messing up that stuff when I started.
You mean the
misspelling? The misspellings and like the grammatical structures and just like looking at how the text reads as yeah. like a joke.
Yeah.
And I think paying more attention to what the text looked like, because Twitter is, to me, notable as a comedy writer, because it's one of the only platforms where like you read the joke instead of like hearing it or right. have it performed
right.
to you, right? Like
right.
So much of it is dependent on how the reader kind of processes the words that they see.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, so like all these accounts were playing with just like syntax and like even just like lower casing everything.
No punctuation. You only
exactly.
had 140 characters. Yeah.
yeah. Creates a different voice, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I was
yeah.
interested in that. And so I just started playing with them. And that's, I just kind of kept at it because I found it really fun and rewarding.
Right.
And I was able to, I think, figure out a voice that I really liked and figure out like a way to translate my thoughts and ideas into something that I found like fun.
But you essentially, in finding your voice, you.
Yeah.
sort of created visually a new vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm supposed to pronounce all the N's and the B's.
I have no idea either. I've never until like right now, I've never had to think about how to pronounce any of this stuff.
So you this was just fun, like just
yeah.
making up a kind of nonsense.
It was yeah.
But
yeah.
but at the same time exploring the notion that within this visual minefield,
mm-hmm.
there's meaning that can be derived.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And like the type of like the ways I developed the typos for it, it took a while, but I was really interested in kind of like keyboard based typos, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
A lot of
slip of the finger.
Yeah, slip of the finger, fat thumbs kind of thing.
Yeah.
So a lot of the things that I found really fun. Because like at that time everyone was sharing like politicians' tweets that had typos in them and
right mistakes
was, yeah and yeah. all these different mistakes, and I thought there was something really compelling about that as well,
right?
And so I tried to like take elements of that and figure out how to craft it, but it really was like for me a writing exercise more than anything,
right?
It was just I wanted, like, architecture school is just as all-encompassing as engineering,
mm-hmm.
and so I wanted a place to like just every day where I could like maybe try to write a joke and try to keep like hone that and keep that up while I was like starving myself being an architecture student.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So when you talk about authority figures kind of fumbling their tweets
yeah.
or their text, and then you as a younger person trying to delve into it a little
yeah.
bit, maybe exploit that
mm-hmm.
sort of scene.
Mm-hmm.
Are you, and this is a big question, I don't know if you've thought this much about it, but are you making any commentary on how younger people use texting
yeah.
and text and
yeah.
texting? Like, we're constantly, I hear all sorts of weird things about our attention spans
yeah.
and, you know, I haven't heard it in a while, but people were lamenting what was going to happen to books and tangible
yeah.
stuff because people were just moving on quickly. They're binge watching or they're mm-hmm. binge reading and then they don't process, but
yeah.
I feel like we're more immersed in language and words
absolutely
than
yeah.
ever. It's like the opposite of what I think was being portrayed,
right?
But anyway, are you saying anything, do you think, about your generation and their relation to text by including this misspelling and whatnot?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. I think I've like the thing that I've really fallen in love with just through the way people communicate on social media is that like new dialects and new like languages and systems of communicating are like just popping up or just maybe getting seen by more people, right? Like
yeah.
there's I think new terminology comes up so much now and so quickly. Like one example is like On Fleek, which was popularized by this black viner named Peaches Monroe. And that story is really interesting because she had this viral Vine blow up and everyone thought Fleek was like a great term and they
yeah.
started using it. And
yeah.
she made no money off of it. And it was both about like the rise of like this new language that came from like a specific subset or culture on the internet, but also how no one kind of credited her for creating that language and everyone else was trying to like monetize it eventually.
Right.
But I am really interested in how, like, I think for me, the idea of the kind of, like, you called it, like, this wall of nonsense in a way, which I really love. But that definitely plays into how I was interested in how people were still able to read the meaning in it, even
yeah.
even if it was messed up. And
right.
I found that there's so much you can infer, even if, like, the actual type is kind of wrong.
Yeah, I guess I'm also curious about it in relation to snobbery or an intellectual argument
yeah,
about
totally,
it.
Yeah,
because I do think that obviously we're living in a very strange time.
Yeah,
and the way people communicate and process fact and fiction and information is very odd. Yeah. I have noted, like every week when I'm looking at my Twitter feed, someone's counter to some, let's say, Trump supporter or alt-right person is to be like, "You're not." Or not there.
Yeah.
So there's still this like, and I
there's like an educational like elitism kind of thing.
There is, and I'm conflicted about that because I'm like, if I have to process a resume and someone gets something wrong and they're 18, I'm still like, there's got to be a QC. There's got to be some quality control here.
Yeah.
Same time, I think you're and people like you are upending that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's good or not. I'm confused. I don't know if. If I raise children, you know, and I'm trying to teach them how to read and write and spell, and I see this proliferation of, like, it's okay to just...
Because
some
whatever,
of it, some of it's a little, like, I don't know if it's nihilistic or what.
Sure, yeah, definitely there's a bit of
nihilism.
Do you
know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So I'm conflicted. I'm not disparaging what you're doing. But I'm also just, like, I think it's funny as a guy who likes comedy and humor, but I also... Now I'm just becoming like a dad rock guy. Like I'm the dad now. I'm like, what is this actually saying if no one cares if anything's spelled right?
Right. Well, I think I've always operated on the assumption that there is a base level of like what is supposed to be. Like what the right way to the quote proper way to do things, unquote, is with language. And like for me, I think the original appeal of creating like an uncharacteristic voice or like typos and lowercase
unconventional
and
voice
unconventional
maybe?
And both with what I was doing and with what like a lot of the Twitter people like the quote weird Twitter unquote people were doing was like a direct kind of comment against like the very carefully constructed like branded language of corporations, of like professional figures, of comedians, of politicians, of like basically all the people who are on Twitter to try to gain something from it, as opposed to just people who are on Twitter for the fun of it,
right?
And so that was like the original mission was to be was to speak against that,
right? Disempower them a little bit, like in terms of their infiltration of the medium,
for
some high-minded or whatever, just selfish goal,
right? Exactly.
Just like actually, this place is absurd and ridiculous, and
And we should play there. Yeah.
So you've written this book that ostensibly that's why we're here to chat today.
Sure, yeah.
And first of all, can you talk about what inspired? Because in reading the kind of coverage of the book, some people view it as an extension of what you've done on Twitter. Uh-huh. Some people are baffled by it completely.
Sure, yeah.
What's your take on this thing?
Well, I guess my take on it was being on Twitter for 4 years now, doing like the things that I do on there, has been essentially a way for me as a writer to like figure out what I want to write about, things I enjoy writing about. I like treat Twitter as like a writer's diary almost.
Right.
Like it's just like the daily kind of output. Right. It's I'm not really thinking about it. It's just like whatever comes across throughout the day.
Yeah, you
I'll
had
have
this
a place to track it.
I read this interview with you recently and you had this remarkable quote about how I think the question was like, what's your favorite book? And you said something like, my favorite book is probably like a writer or an artist's notebook, like a blank notebook filled by a writer or artist.
Yeah.
Could be the most compelling thing, just them sketching and writing just ideas down.
Right.
That would fascinate you the most.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your interaction with Twitter is, in a sense, kind of
a writer's sketchbook.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's kind of just like ideas that I think are interesting that I'll try to put out there in some form, and we'll just let it sit there. Like I don't see Twitter as like a primary creative. Like final output.
It's like a process oriented medium to you?
Yeah, for me, yeah.
That's
fascinating. And as like I try to approach it just as a writer. So I'm just using it as a way to like figure out develop my voice and figure out what I want to talk about.
That's interesting because I think some people who use it and are semi successful at it, so to speak. That's just it. How do you grade success on a process oriented vehicle? I guess the tweets, retweets and the likes. It kind of can discourage some people from actually putting those ideas out there.
Because,
no one that didn't resonate with anyone,
right.
that There's, idea must yeah. be bad.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it might just die.
Yeah.
Because you get the instant judgment.
Exactly. And there's such like a danger. It's like an appeal and a danger of like seeing all the numbers immediately, right? Like,
right.
I know a lot of people who run their Twitter accounts and like are obsessed with like the data and
yes,
like seeing
yes.
the metrics and seeing how the tweet does and mm-hmm. seeing if it like connects with audiences and stuff. And for me, it's less, I'm less focused on that because I don't think I'm trying to like run a business on Twitter. I don't think I'm trying to like create like a brand on Twitter. I feel like I'm just putting stuff out there
yeah.
to see what like kind of just to see if it if I like it and to see if it connects with some people or not.
Right. Okay. How is the book related to how you employ Twitter?
After being on Twitter for this long, I was kind of like, what is the project that like is coming out of this or what? It's not necessarily what does it lead to, but. As I was working on Twitter, I was like, I feel like I want, now that all this work kind of exists in sort of sketch form, how do I like kind of coalesce it into like an actual narrative or like a single object in a way?
Mm-hmm.
And so the book kind of was the result of that. For a while, I wanted it to be a webcomic and I wanted it to be like just a weekly thing where I took an idea that I put on Twitter and I illustrated it and put it online.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about, as I was thinking about that, I realized that it would be more fun and maybe more challenging to try to do it as like a traditional kind of narrative story, something
right.
with a beginning, middle, end. And I guess looking through like the tweets and stuff,
my own tweets.
I found like common threads and certain pieces that I want to include in the book. And I started, so those became like little landmarks. And then the challenge was how do I weave a story through these things I already know I want to put in the book
right.
and create like this full narrative.
The primary character is an alien, or sorry, a alien.
Sure.
And talk about the alien.
Yeah, the alien is...
I mean, he or she is one of many mm-hmm, characters, mm-hmm. actually. Yeah.
Yeah, and the alien is a tribute to the listener and like the quiet outsider. I thought it was really fun to write a protagonist who... mainly doesn't further the action. Like they're
he's observing.
To,
he's an observer, and
yeah.
that's what his purpose is. Really.
Yeah. Like. Yeah. Yeah.
He's or she.
Yeah. They're.
Saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, the alien.
Yeah. The alien's there to kind of just witness and to
right.
to see and, it was kind of this joyful thing. I liked the story of having someone there who, everything was happening around them.
Yeah.
And. They kind of like come in and see a bunch of stuff and then maybe slightly affect the outcome of stuff. But it's very autobiographical in the sense that I feel like entering some of these worlds and communities, I've always felt like the outsider and I've always felt like someone on the periphery of all the action. And so I wanted to write a story that kind of reflected that.
You relate the most to the hedgehog, though?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, as I was writing it, I was thinking about like what it meant to try to create this thing out
yeah.
of nothing. And the hedgehog is kind of like the insecurities of, I think, any like beginner artist.
I see. Okay.
And so I maybe selfishly put all those insecurities into the book as a different character.
Okay.
But yeah, that definitely was the character I related to the most while I was working on it.
My reading of the book and
uh-huh.
the landscape in particular
yeah.
is that it could be a stand-in for the internet.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a huge kind of, for me, there was a huge intentional metaphor for especially the social media kind of internet.
Yeah.
Where the narrative structure of the book is a direct kind of mapping of the narrative structure of like a timeline, a Twitter timeline, an Instagram timeline, or whatever.
Sure, right.
It's kind of the structure of it is like an alien comes to Earth or a user like follows a bunch of different characters they encounter and then you just see their stories pop up interspersed and amongst all the other things.
Right.
So that's kind of the narrative structure that the book takes too.
Yeah, yeah.
Where like it's not split into chapters, like this is the hedgehog chapter, this is the egg chapter, this is whatever, but it's really like
sort of episodic.
Yeah. And
yeah.
like you see all these small updates and it's up to the reader to kind of like parse it out and
That's
like keep track of everything. Yeah.
That's fascinating. So we talked about your comedy, uh-huh. Your interest in comedy and potentially your influence as a comedian, as a writer,
yeah.
graphically.
Yeah.
Talk about your illustrative or graphic
mm-hmm.
inspirations. I'm just curious.
Yeah. So like I did the book as kind of a tribute to all the books that I read when I was a kid, like all the writer illustrators I was interested in as a kid, like
yeah.
Shel Silverstein, Bill Watterson's Calvin and Hobbes,
right.
Morris Sendak was another one, like the Winnie the Pooh
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of series. So all those kind of that was kind of like the visual DNA. And the other part of, like, I'm obsessed with just like very simple line drawings. And as an illustrator, I'd done a lot of work before doing this book in kind of figuring out what that looked like. And I'd done some street arts and some installations and just illustrated pieces that were all kind of focused around those ideas.
Right.
And those came from like different architects and the kind of minimalist styles they employed. And also some street artists, like there's a street artist named Blue, who is I believe he's a French street artist who does like these very simple but intricate black and white line drawings.
Okay.
So I think all those kind of influences coalesced into the style.
Okay.
As well.
Yeah. Well, I know you have to go. Yeah. So our time in the park is ending.
Sure.
What's next for you? Can you talk about that? You've got school. Do you have other? Is the book doing well? Are you happy with how it's being received?
I'm very happy with the book. I'm blown away with the fact that people are reading it. Regardless of anything.
It's crazy when you make something and people actually process it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I'm really happy with how the book's doing. I think I have to focus on school for a little bit.
Okay.
But at the same time, I think I get to take the chance to take a little bit of a creative break.
Yeah.
For a few months and just wait to see what becomes interesting next.
Okay.
Because that's kind of how the book came about. It was kind of just like, I really want to do this.
Organically.
And now I feel like I have to do it because I've been thinking about it so much.
Right.
So I'm trying to wait to see what happens.
Okay.
Next. Yeah.
Where can people learn more about you on the internet and on Twitter?
On Twitter, I'm at Johnny Sun. I have an Instagram account too, but I that's kind of less active, but that's Jomny Sun.
Right.
And then my book's called Everyone's an Alien When You're an Alien Too. If you search for it, it's the one that has the misspelled title.
That's right. Okay.
And that's available everywhere.
Do you have like a website?
Yeah, I do have a website. My personal is jonathan-sun.com, and then my like Twitter associated one is jomnysun.com.
Okay. All right. John, this was a pleasure. Thank you for making time for being with me in this park, and I hope you have a beautiful day and a wonderful life.
Thank you. Thank you. You too. Thank you.
Special thanks again to Johnny Sun for making time to be on this show and to have a chat with me, and also the fine people at HarperCollins Canada for setting that up. Again, Johnny's new book is called Everyone's a Alien When You're a Alien Too. And it's great. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed reading it. I'm going to read it again because there's stuff in there that I missed, I think, the first time. And I want to get it after having this conversation with him. I feel like there's more to it. So anyway, thank you, Johnny. And thank you, HarperCollins. And follow him on Twitter, obviously, and check out his book. Great, great stuff. This is the 337th episode of the Creative Control podcast, which is available on things like iTunes, Audioboom, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Overcast, and all your finer podcast platforms. It's also on my website, vishkana.com, where you can learn more about me and the show. And if you're missing any episodes, they should all be there. You can like Creative Control with Vishkana on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter at vishcreative or at vishkana. And a version of this show airs every Wednesday at noon Eastern Standard Time around the world at CFRU.ca, or if you're in the Guelph area, 93.3 FM on your radio dial. Also, you can go to patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to the program, and in return, I will send you a t-shirt. So let me know if you've made your donation, and we can work something out. This episode would not be possible without our sponsors, Pizza Trocadero, whom you can call for pickup or delivery at 519-829-2444, or check them out at trocaderoguelph.ca. Amazing pizza in Guelph. And The Bookshelf, an independently owned bookstore, bar, music venue, and movie theater located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. Learn more about them at bookshelf.ca. Planet Bean, freshly roasted, fair trade certified organic coffee. For more information about them, visit planetbeancoffee.com. And Granddad's Donuts, located at 574 James Street North in Hamilton, Ontario. Amazing, incredible donuts. In fact, I recall after this Johnny Sun conversation that I went to Granddad's Donuts and asked them to be a sponsor, and they said yes, and I ate some donuts, and they gave me a bagel sandwich for free as part of the deal. So they're great. Visit granddads.ca. for more information about Granddad's Donuts. All right, that's it for me. Thanks for listening to the show, and continue to listen to the show and tell your friends about the show and subscribe to the show on all your podcast platforms, download episodes, rate the show, review the show. apparently it all helps do something, and I appreciate it. So thank you. Talk to you soon. Goodbye for now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.